Hey folks, and welcome to the Daily Ratings Podcast. It's a show where each week we'll sit down with Vincent Daly to get his thoughts on the latest movies he's been watching, both older films and new releases. And don't worry, there's no spoilers. Vince will give a brief review of the movie, share some thoughts, and of course, then rate the film. The Daily Ratings are always fair, honest, and most importantly, they're consistent. On today's show, Vince will be rating and reviewing Moby Dick, directed by John Huston, Basic Instinct by Paul Verhoeven, Drag Me to Hell by Sam Raimi, Waiting for the Barbarians by Ciro Guerrera, and newly released Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, directed by Sam Raimi. So stay tuned and enjoy the show. Mr. Vincent Daly, how we doing, buddy?
Tommy boy, how's it going?
It's going pretty well. How was your week of movies, man?
Week was pretty good. I was surprised. It was going to be scrambling a little bit in the beginning to figure out what was the cohesion between this, but watched some impressive movies. I'm excited to talk about them.
Yeah, I kind of like the array of films we have here.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah.
And through the decades that we went and everything like that, I think it's pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And you started off with quite the classic as well.
Right, yeah, yeah. Definitely the slight challenge I have for myself to try to just tackle 50s movies.
Yeah, we've talked about it before. You were fearful that you don't like 50s movies.
Yeah.
And what we started with, the Kane Mutiny,
it was not
helpful.
Yeah, it was not good. So Moby Dick was on my list. I thought Orson Welles played Ahab, but it's actually Gregory Peck, but still, I was impressed with it. So
okay. Jump into it right there.
Yeah, we can get right into it.
We're back there in 1956. This is Moby Dick. And what do we have with this classic here, Vince?
So, 1956, pretty interesting year for film coming out. We, of course, have classics like The Searchers coming out at this time. Surprising that Moby Dick, this is the only, I believe only two of mainline film adaptations. There's one in the 90s with Patrick Stewart, I think.
But might be one in 2011 or something.
Oh, really?
That.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Still.
I was just surprised that this wasn't retread.
Constantly.
Yeah, almost near constantly.
The book came out at the turn of the century or so much older than that?
Older. I think Melville was like, this is like 1851 or something
like that. Oh, the mid-1800s. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right, yeah.
This is like old school whaling.
Yeah, I was surprised it wasn't a film in the 20s or 30s.
Yeah, I'm...
And then remade in the 50s and then remade in the 90s. Yeah,
yeah, it makes sense in the 50s because you have a lot of classics, a lot of classic tales being told,
yeah,
you know, for that, for the
true
blockbuster. But man, I just a quick note that I was surprised that we don't have more experience with this story. I'm not going to bother summarizing it too much. The story of Moby Dick is, in the book, is primarily a kind of a technical whaling novel, you know, detailing a lot of what it took to be a whaling sailorman.
Yeah, to actually.
Yeah, back then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of
life of the sailor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely.
And through that, you obviously have the story of Captain Ahab, who has a rivalry with Moby Dick, a great white whale or a pale whale, and hunting that. This movie, very similarly, is kind of cast through the eyes of crewmen. I wouldn't necessarily call Ahab our main character. Instead, we are at the crew level, and I think that is one of the first brilliant uses from text to screenplay in this, and keeping that. I think there's probably a lot of temptation to just make Ahab the focus, but we need to experience,
yeah,
Ahab and the problems with Ahab through other eyes, you know, because he's obviously, you know, feverishly around this hunt for this whale.
Yeah,
so.
And I would just assume he would have, like, Gregory Peck would have the biggest...
Oh, for sure.
The biggest presence and also, like, a huge amount of screen time.
But exactly.
It's shared? It's actually shared among the sailors?
It's shared, and a lot is done to the crew, and we'll get into that in just a bit. Don't get me wrong, though. Peck is a huge part of this and an amazing part as well.
Yeah,
you know, it lives up for sure.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah, pretty stunning talent around this one, though. Ray Bradbury is behind adapting this story for the screen, which is pretty huge, I think. Yeah. Like I said, what I know the legacy of Moby Dick to be is a pretty boring book about, you know, the technical aspect of whaling in the 1800s. So having Ray Bradbury establish this and a legend, kind of adapt this for the screen, I think is important to what is done to make this film snappy, to make it probably more a little bit more blockbusterish for 1956. Nonetheless, a very successful screenplay of making it engaging for the audience and enveloping the audience. Part of that stunning talent is Gregory Peck himself. Holy smokes, is he good in this.
He really carries it.
He's so good.
There's a reason why he's still to this day.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
A massive name.
Yeah, and where I wasn't disappointed, I thought Ahab was going to be Orson Welles in this for some reason. I had that marked down in my notes for it, but he really lived up to it. I mean, really amazing as Captain Ahab. He sells the danger of an ultra-charismatic character, or rather leader specifically, and the crew is just so entranced, so transfixed on this. We almost have sea rituals of them drinking together and kind of falling into the same kind of feverishness that Ahab has.
Sure, yeah.
He really fixes his crew together almost to the point that there's only a few, if only one character that's against Ahab in this. And you'd think, well, maybe that's a little tough to keep the drama on the ship up to speed, but it's just so... he's just so entertaining to watch. Has the same type of magic that we see in, like, Daniel Plainview in There'll Be Blood or something like that. A charismatic element that you love, but underneath that, he is incredibly menacing and, you know, wrong as well in his pursuit.
It's so easy to be fixated on that character. Like, joy to watch.
Absolutely.
Like, joy to watch on screen.
Yeah. I will say, if I had to maybe balance it out a little bit, the peg leg, the whalebone peg leg, it's a little bit silly. I'm trying to see, I was looking at it, and I think prosthetic work is just, it's pretty much Peck just with his leg in there, you know? It doesn't necessarily look like a cut-off limb.
Right, right.
A lot is done with the cartoonish aspects of the peg-legged captain sailor that I feel is such a legacy coming off of Moby Dick as well. A lot is done atmospherically. He walks on top of the deck while the crew is sleeping. You're hearing this stomping around. I would say, I mean, if I really want to be even generous, it kind of creates a ticking clock as well. Over, you know, them hunting closer and closer to Moby Dick.
Yeah, that's very Christopher Nolan-ish.
Yeah.
That time aspect, or just that something in the background that's ticking, knocking a little bit. Yeah,
absolutely. Keeps a little bit of the pacing alive.
It does, yeah, for sure.
Orson Welles, who is in it as well, a short segment in the beginning, but very solid. He kind of sets the tone for this story as a preacher in the whaling town, and it really just sets the mood of danger for the story. I would say this story, I've never read the full novel, but also deeply religious as well, for the type of the moral or the point of what ambition, blind ambition,
right,
or kind of a crusade like Ahab has. What does that mean for our characters and their humanity as well? So Orson Welles is, I think it's Father something?
Father Maple.
Father Maple,
yeah. And when you say he sets the tone off well, I think that's incredibly important, especially and when you're going back now, how far, you know, we're in the 50s and you're watching a movie. He sold it in the sense of it was engaging.
Oh, yeah.
After him, you were engaged with it. It wasn't, I don't want to say eye-rolly, but sometimes when you watch an older film or something like that, especially because we're watching the here and now, those older films kind of can take you in and out of it with kind of the ridiculousness or pushing something that you're just not buying.
Sure.
So to step off right away, I think that's important, and to have Orson Welles do it, like set the mood and set it correctly for the audience watching. I think that's good.
Absolutely. And there's plenty of still 50s brotherliness as a theme in this, just because I think that's a product of the film industry at the time. And I think Orson's part in the beginning kind of sets a tone and saying, hey, these, you know, this is, you know, the lives are at danger. The church that he has, the stage or the podium is a ship mass that's built into the church. The walls are lined with graves. It was almost, I don't know, I mean, maybe that was depicted in the novel itself, but it was cool. It was almost like a fantasy type of Christian church.
Yeah, that is cool.
That's pretty cool. Yeah, but I think it's an important note. Not only is Orson killing it in this little, very short scene in the beginning, but I think is a key to setting the foreboding tone of this film.
That's good, yeah.
And what keeps kept me interested, because obviously, you know, it's not going to be easy times for the crew going up against Moby Dick. Like I said, some stunning set work. I think why I am so immensely positive on this film is because the set work was just so good. This wailing church, I mean, it looks like a gothic horror church. The ship itself on the water, they are using rear projection where they have the screen behind them on some things, but a lot of shots are just straight up on the water, and obviously it's probably done in like a bay or something like that.
No, something, but, yeah, sure. Yeah, keeping the shore out of focus or something like that, but
it's just such a different feel than like a studio film that you would get.
Especially in the 50s.
Yeah, exactly.
Especially like this at that rear projection, which can look so crap often.
Absolutely, Some weird stuff is done with color design as well that I was interested, specifically when the crew is waiting for Moby Dick at a certain point. They're waiting under full moonlight, and the film kind of turns into a grayscale monochromatic at parts, which I was like, wow, I mean, it's clearly on purpose, but interesting designs all around.
Was it the fact that they were filming a night scene during the day, so it was just filters that they had to use?
That definitely probably could be it. Stylistically, though, I think they did a good job.
It worked out okay.
Yeah, it pulled off.
It's funny, actually, say The Searchers that came out the same year. There's night scenes that I get the same vibe, where it's just like it's very clearly daytime, but it's not, and they're doing okay at just like making the moon look bright, essentially.
Yeah.
And just replacing the moon for the sun, almost, in a way.
Absolutely.
But that's good that it worked out, though.
Yeah, yeah. I would say most surprising around some of this set work are the action sequences. They're good.
That's awesome. They are not bad. That's so cool.
The action sequences around whales, because again, we're not just after Moby Dick. This is a story around almost an entire campaign, a season, if you will, of whaling leading up to it.
Okay, right.
The whales, from what I can tell, there's definitely some sort of puppeteer work or possibly maybe even like some animatronics that they have to show like the back of the whale on it. And it looks good. Basically, what they do is they have a fixed camera on these rowboats that are coming out from the ship.
Yeah.
So there is a cool kind of camera design of a swaying back and forth.
Oh.
And it really, it's an emerging quality. You know, it immerses you into the film. And then when they hook the whale, they're clearly just putting, you know, motors on the back of those little rowboats, and it's fast. It's a good action scene. It has excitement and...
That's really cool. And to hold up like that, it's like practical effects. Actually, pretty basic stuff probably happening. And how was the camera work in general as far as... So when you're on the boat, basically, especially the smaller boats, the camera work is good. I mean, there's not like they have steady cams or anything like that.
I think the cinematography is a huge highlight for me. For one, with when it's on those smaller boats, they're either on a secondary, you know, canoe or rowboat to the side.
Yeah, sure, okay.
But always the camera is fixed to the actual rocking of the ship.
I can see that getting out of hand, but not so much.
It's good, honestly. Okay. I thought it was good as far as kind of... We have to be on those crashy waters with them. And again, to the immersive quality of it, when whales are around, the rocking is a lot more, specifically when the title Moby Dick comes around.
Right, right.
You know, it's a very chaotic, and I think that translates to an action scene that still stands up. Like, it was exciting.
That's really
moments.
Cool. That's
yeah,
awesome. Yeah,
exactly. I would say cinematography, a huge credit there for me, because it has probably some of the best Dutch angles I've ever seen. And I'm not a fan of Dutch angles. You know, it's kind of a very simple, lazy trick, you know.
You get overused a lot.
Exactly. Yeah. And for folks at home, I mean, it's been even a couple good episodes since we've talked about anything or referenced that. But a Dutch angle is when the camera is just cocked to a diagonal view or tilted in some way. Because of the fixed nature of the camera on the boat, we have a natural tipping and scaling to this. Where this is such a wonderful implementation is that we have, obviously, Ahab getting more and more feverish into this hunt after Moby Dick. Again, the swaying of the camera is going to increase more and more as we get closer to Moby Dick. So there's kind of a building momentum of the visual language on screen. And it is a brilliant match because guess what? Ahab is about as crazy as you get. So a Dutch angle is suited to his mental state.
To his actual kind of manic way.
Yeah, when he's talking to his first mate and he's going on these long, you know, almost Shakespearean rants of what it means to capture Moby Dick and what he feels his fate and destined and, you know, how he'll live on and whatnot. You know, all of that, we see the rocking getting more and more intense. And again, you know, if this was just that cinematography, it would be good. I would give it a lot of credit. If it was just Gregory Peck on a sound stage, just acting his ass off, phenomenal.
Yeah.
The combination of both together is why this is really, you know, a high ranking film
movie.
For me.
This is
yes.
a good film.
Yes. This is follow through. This is creative follow through, but this is also creative vision and understanding the text very deeply.
And I was just about to make it, when you say understanding the text is huge, because when you're taking one of the biggest novels ever.
Yeah.
Yeah, how easy that is to make.
Absolutely.
And it's the first time it's put to screenplay.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's, you know, it's a lot that can go wrong,
yeah,
I think, for sure.
For sure. And it was just, again, I think even if the subject matter of it doesn't entice you, if the age kind of scares you off, if you don't have any connection to the actors, I think what kind of holds it all up is that the action, against all odds, is pretty great.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It has, and that's where I kind of say it's a little bit blockbustery because it does have a lot of action sequences.
And
with
that's
these
awesome.
Whales.
And when you have the good action on top of good dialogue and good actors performing the writing, it's quite the good cherry on top.
Yeah,
yeah.
Absolutely. I will say it still has a very distinct 50s upbeat tone. It's very camaraderie, brotherhood, very kind of pick yourself up by the bootstraps and whistle while you work tone to it.
Yeah, yeah.
It works and it doesn't. I think it works because it is a breath of fresh air to the craziness of Ahab. We finally get a relief. And I think it's also important characterization for the crew that they're getting wrapped up in Ahab's craziness. They themselves are not, you know? So we don't get kind of a cartoonish depiction of the crew. I would say in modern day, this is probably where I would give it a slight knock. If folks at home, you're, you know, passionate against whaling, this is a very odd tone for the whaling to take. That, you know, they're always referencing, oh, what good this oil will do to light the lamps back in the colonies, and you know, it's very this work
it's
matters
for the time.
For,
yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, you're talking mid 1800s,
yeah,
really, yeah,
exactly,
absolutely.
That's where I think I give it a pass.
Yeah.
But as far as watching the movie as a piece of art itself, maybe that tone won't sit great with some people. I would stress, though, we got to understand, I mean, it is, you know, it is still trying to tell the story initial to the
exactly
novel.
Exactly right. You know? Exactly right.
And that would be the mindset at the time, you know, that they're doing great work for, you know,
oh my gosh,
makeup
yeah.
and lamp oil.
Sure.
You know? Yeah. A quick note here as well. There is a straight up Goodfellas Scorsese scene introduction into this. I swear to God. And especially for Scorsese, who loves this decade of films. I mean, The Searchers, same year, and you know. Well, I don't know if we can unveil it for the, podcast. Just,
Scorsese has said that in some interviews, he says The Searchers is his favorite film. In other ones, he says it's one of his favorite films. Mm-hmm. Regardless, The Searchers is big time one of his top, if not the top.
And way back when Tom and I kind of, not encyclopedically, but we went through a lot of Westerns in kind of the early days doing the ratings.
On my behalf, you did that.
Yeah. And I do not like The Searchers at all. So I think it's I forget what we gave it, but...
we gave it a score. Well, we knew you didn't like it. And then we go, maybe you got to watch it again. Maybe you got to watch it. So they watch it again. And then now it's...
I think I liked it worse.
And then it's to the point where just like, I think you've watched it three times now.
Yeah. And I'll probably watch it a fourth for the podcast now. So,
like, damn straight.
Yeah. But this is a completely side note, you know, not really to the criticism of this film or the praise of the film, really, so far. But
as far as Scorsese goes.
What
are you doing liking that movie? And not this,
yeah. But I think he may have stole it, or you know, it's always on the shoulders of giants, but he stole the Goodfellas introduction scene. The intro to the crew in this is very quick pace. It doesn't feel like a 50s film at all. It's snapping around to the different crew members, and they're all shown in, like, them doing something, you know, iconic to, like, what their nickname is or something like that. It feels right out of the bar intro to Goodfellas.
Really?
Like, yeah.
A snappy song going?
Not a snappy song, but like the editing, the cuts, and how many crew members they fit into this intro. I'm telling you, this has to be in the DNA of Scorsese.
It's not like
somewhere.
A 70s cop show.
No.
You're like doing action sequence kind of, you know.
No. And there's no like freeze frames or anything like that. Okay. It's very natural, but I'm telling you, just how the cadence of the editing, it has to be in the recent memories when he was making Goodfellas. it's just a theory, but I really couldn't shake it. Like, it looks exactly like it, which is cool.
That's cool.
I really do mean like on the shoulder of giants too. Like, that's totally fine.
Yeah.
We're talking about, you know, 90s. To 65, 66 or 56, but yeah, granted, this movie rides on a lot of coattails of a classic story, and maybe I can balance some of my praise out here. That is it really the hardest thing to do, to ham it up and act very Shakespearean on screen? Sure. I mean, maybe there is, if you're just reading the text, it's not the biggest thing in the world, but what Peck does, what the production does, how snappy and surprisingly entertaining this film is for going back to 1956.
Yeah.
You know, I think this was a very, very impressive film, and really kind of crafts its own identity beyond just, oh, yeah, and that's the movie version of the book, you know?
Yeah.
Not only that, I mean, top to bottom, this is a perfect example of what I look for in standing the test of time. I can't stress enough that maybe without these action films, this film would be a hell of a lot more boring, but boring is not anywhere close to what I would say coming off of watching this. And I just think that is just so surprising. Surprising probably for audiences getting a thrill in 1956, and surprising for me because I am saying this is absolutely a big boy alert.
Woo!
Absolutely worth your time in modern day. We're going to go ahead and give Moby Dick an 87.
Ooh, wow.
Absolutely a must watch.
An 87 in the must watch, that is a big boy alert. Wow, 87.
Watch Peck act his butt off. Take note of
all.
The action. It's great.
Wow. Okay.
It's a great movie.
That's fantastic.
Save the 50s for me. Folks, the decade.
Seriously. Wow. That's you needed that, really.
I did.
After the Caine Mutiny. Jeez. Okay, folks. All right. So Moby Dick with an 87. That is huge. We'll see if anything can top it here. But boy, 87s, that's really up there.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Kind of the intended format that I wanted for Caine Mutiny, to kind of bring up the scores of the week.
Yes.
And this was thankfully lived up to the legend.
How classic is that, where all the movies where you just assume are going to be phenomenal sometimes fail?
Sure.
And then the ones that it's just like, all right, I'll watch this. Phenomenal movie.
Right, exactly.
Very fantastic. All right, 87, high score for Moby Dick there. All right, so we're going to move on here. Number of decades, we're in 1992. This is still in our Paul Verhoeven kind of study that that you're doing. This is Basic Instinct by Paul Verhoeven. And Vin, what do we have with this?
Back with the rated R king himself. Like I said last week with Total Recall, where I thought his trademark was probably world building. I actually think it's probably just violence and nudity because there's not really any of these commercials or media within the world kind of
that's funny.
Building upon it. Yeah,
it
totally
has been
drops
a through
off.
Line since you were expecting.
Maybe it's just for his sci-fi because it definitely comes back for Starship Troopers.
Right.
But
really, nothing there for that.
Yeah, and especially with the next one up, we're on to the last two. It's going to be Showgirls, an NC-17 movie, plays more into. You know, clearly he likes just making these hardcore movies.
Yeah, wow, okay.
He likes blood and nudity, and then you know Starship Troopers being the final entry there. So, Basic Instinct, though, I would say overall lives up to the hype. This movie was a little bit more straightforward than I thought. I thought it was going to have a little bit more twisted turns for the mystery aspect of it. Michael Douglas here is playing a pretty good job. He plays a homicide detective with a sketchy past in San Francisco when a trail of murders begin to match events found within a fictional crime novels, kind of paperback schlock, if you will.
Okay.
The author becomes the main suspect in these murders. That author is Sharon Stone, and I would say, while I wasn't maybe like in love with this movie, Sharon Stone is really amazing in this. All the praise that I gave last week with Total Recall, I mean,
she was great in Total Recall.
Oh, yeah, exactly. This is now her sole stage, you know, where she was just simply supporting in Total Recall.
Right, of course.
I think that's exactly where I get a lot of enjoyment in watching movies in sequential order. Clearly, Verhoeven or his casting, had Sharon Stone earlier in her career with Total Recall, and clearly they enjoyed working together. Guess what? Next movie, she's now the lead. You know what I mean? I think that's a cool progression to look at. She plays the author in this, and I would say it's a bit odd of a character. She is very sexual. She is a provocateur. She likes pushing buttons. Specifically, she likes making men very nervous around here. We see this, of course, in the titular scene of she's getting interrogated, mm-hmm. and she kind of uncrosses her legs.
Yeah.
And when it comes to the character, it's the same kind of femme fatale energy that we see in Total Recall. I would say it just rides a little bit of unbelievability. I mean, the situation here is that this author is being accused of multiple murders that match her writing to a T. I mean, down to murder weapon, down to method of killing. The whole nine, and she's just provoking cops and like thinking, you know, it just feels
it's a little too much.
Yeah, it feels cartoonish. Like she would absolutely be placed in like without bail. You know,
right,
I mean?
Right.
She'd be placed in custody for how much she provokes them. But this cat and mouse is important because this is kind of supposed to be a sexy romance between her. Digging her claws into Michael Douglas and getting under his skin, which it's good. I like it. She's very badass in this, but like I said, it just comes off a bit laughable how cartoonish some scenes are. Maybe that's in modern day. I don't know. But that was kind of my thoughts. Does that make sense?
Oh my gosh, absolutely. Yeah. Well, it gets to a point where it's just like, all right, okay,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely a character in that.
Right,
you know?
But it's like you're trying to oversell the character. Like like you said, femme fatale, we get what she's trying to do or what this character's supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
Don't push it.
Yeah.
Don't push it on us.
Yeah.
You have enough there already, is what
exactly.
It seems like. Yeah,
yeah. There's almost too much of brazenness to it. There's too much provoking where I wish maybe she would have played it back a little bit more and drew them in or manipulated the men in a different way than just, you know, pushing buttons.
Yeah,
so.
And it gets gets unbelievable. At
yeah,
a certain extent.
Yeah. But this is this is a folks. This is a very horny movie. Do not watch this with your parents, and if you're a parent, don't watch it with your kids. I would say that is part of I think the appeal here. I mean, 92, we are way past super raunchy 70s films that would show everything.
Mm-hmm, sure.
This film, if anything, maybe is in line with that a little bit more and really just doesn't hold any punches. So I think, listen, I'm a guy. it was you know, great to see on screen. I just think that the film maybe leans on it a little bit too much.
When it almost takes away from the actual story.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
It's trying to be, it's just like, all right, dude. Like,
yeah,
do you care about your, like,
right, yeah. Right. And really, I'm not saying this like a prude or anything like that. I mean,
no,
I think.
Watch it for what the movie is.
Yeah, I think it does play into the character that Sharon Stone does have to be a sexual character
yeah.
for how she's described, and also, you know, in writing these novels, they are novels of passion. They're paperback kind of romance,
right,
you know, with
right.
murder mystery.
Yeah.
So her kind of participating in that definitely does have follow through, something that Lost City did not have.
I'd say the same thing.
Yeah, the amount of times that Lost City has to stay in recent memories is driving me nuts. But yeah, I would say as sex and violence being the single elevator pitch here, it's just a little bit one note. Scenes are, you know, passionate, great to look at. Story-wise, though, we really circle the drain on the same points slightly being peeled back by Douglas as our detective. For instance, Michael Douglas is going to find one piece of information, like where her character went to school, and then he's going to go to the school and mm-hmm. find out he was wrong, and then he goes back to her, and then he finds out a little bit more information, and then he follows that lead. It just, it doesn't have a dynamic nature that you want in a detective story.
Okay, sure.
And in which case, you know, hey, if it's just supposed to be a sexy kind of thriller, that's fine, but the detective side, with our main character being a detective, really fell short.
A little lackluster.
It is not. It doesn't create an engagement in the audience
okay,
for the
gotcha.
Script itself. It's just rinse and repeat. You know, on
yeah,
you know, him peeling back layers slightly, investigating, coming back for the same.
It's
layers.
Like Verhoeven is the movie is so much about the two of them and their mm-hmm. dynamic, where the detective aspect and actually figuring things out takes a back seat. Is what it seems like.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe not. What
and
you
maybe
want.
That's a no duh, but honestly. I
yeah,
mean, the
but,
film is putting in your face that it is about the murder. You know, opening
right,
scene
no,
is
for
a murder.
Sure. Yeah.
So, yeah. So that's where it's kind of, you know, I didn't exactly think it was a groundbreaking film because, again, Circles the Drain is what I would describe it
okay.
as. So just some quick notes with camera work and some of the setting here. Camera work is really trend setting in some aspects. It actually reminded me a lot of like a David Fincher type of zoom into when characters huh. are pressed on the truth. Very Zodiac
okay.
In how it was done.
Okay.
Obviously, this was, you know, way before those interest those movies, but could be a trendsetter in that type of way. What I'm describing is that, and in like a Zodiac as well, when a character is pressed for the truth, we'll have the camera kind of do a slight dip and then a zoom in to their face. And I think it's you know, it's something that we see in thrillers still to modern day because
yeah.
it's a great way for the audience to kind of have their own lie detector test and see, is this character the truth? What do I think as the
sure,
audience?
Sure, yeah. It's a focusing in on that moment and the intensity of it too. Reading the character's face and everything.
Mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
that's funny that, like you said, you've seen it in so many films, but mm-hmm. this is one of the earlier ones that you've seen it in.
Yeah, and it was so emphasized where, if anything, now it's maybe done a little bit more subtly as they zoom into it.
Okay.
But it was such like a, whoa, that this is like a very dramatic
but good.
Movement.
It worked.
Oh,
it?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Absolutely. And trendsetter is, you know, I mean, it's a trend for a reason.
Yeah.
You know what I
yeah,
mean?
Yeah, for sure.
So, also, some cool kind of action choreography. There's an assault with a car at one point. And once again, the camera work, I was like, wow, that's pretty cool.
Okay.
You know? And more so specifically, the types of camera work that I was not seeing in RoboCop, in Total Recall. So pleasantly, this film kind of tested some of my theories, kind of tested my reason for watching and even, you know, some of my forming assumptions
sure.
over what the Verhoeven film was. This kind of shook it up, and I think that deserves some credit.
Yeah, and in a lot of good ways is what it seems like,
yeah.
for sure. Maybe in other ways, kind of digging his heels too much in other ways,
mm-hmm.
just leaning into sex and blood.
Yeah, leaning into the serious violence.
But
serious
it is good. Nudity. And maybe it's him, like you said before, of just changing things up because just as, you know, we're stepping away from sci-fi now.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe for him, it was a big, it's like, okay, let's change things.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
It's kind of nice, really, yeah.
For a 90s film, this, of course, is set in San Francisco. I think we actually see the Full House in one of the... in one of the chase sequences. You know, I mean, I don't know. I don't want to give it over amounts of credit, but there is a lot of creativity used in that environment. A lot of chase sequences done in the city streets. You know, I mean, not that that's out of place. Of course, that's been used in Clint Eastwood films and, you know, in plenty of action sequences like that.
Sure.
But when it comes to it, I think specifically car chases done with the city streets. It was something of note.
Yeah, so, that's good.
Overall, I thought this movie lived up to the hype. I wasn't maybe a huge fan of it, but by no means was this a bad movie. Like I said, the detective elements are a little bit too basic for me, a little bit too straightforward, especially when that really is our main focus of why we are paying attention to the story, that it is a murder mystery and we need to unpack whether Sharon Stone is the killer or is she not by her duplicity. It also comes with the understanding that this movie is more about the crime and passion than the detective story itself. That said, it is the detective story that progresses things forward. It is the main mover. It is the, you know, the agent of change. So when it comes to that being simple, I think it really does weaken the overall experience, even though how gripping the violence and explicit aspects of this film may be. Nothing too critical, but I would say that's where I come a little bit more lackluster than I think the legacy of this movie would leave it up to be. We're going to go ahead and give Basic Instinct a 68.
Oh, it's 68. Yeah, that's right there with what you were saying, basically.
Yeah. Definitely a good movie, definitely above average.
Exactly.
If anything, very, very well trending to well worth your time.
Yeah,
but,
for sure.
Yeah.
I think that's a good notes to make. You know, that's good to see that Verhoeven is doing things differently and hitting in some ways, maybe not in others, but I think a 68 represents that completely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey, this is a pretty good movie.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool. All right, so that's 1992. Okay, so we're jumping to 2009 here. A movie that was not on my radar or really that I even could remember, to be honest with you. So this is Drag Me to Hell.
Yeah.
2009, directed by... who was the director? Sam Raimi.
Sam Raimi.
Of course, yes.
Yeah, yeah. This was my Sam Raimi slot because he's directing Doctor Strange.
Yes, and yes, of course.
Wanted to do it. I could have very easily done the Spider-Man movies, but believe me, I am superhero movied out. the ripples of the Morbius episode will haunt me for a while. But yeah, I wanted to give Sam Raimi more of a shot with him taking on Doctor Strange. His modern films are primarily that Spider-Man series. And when we think about that Spider-Man series, that really started the whole MCU thing off. You know, it may not be MCU proper, but definitely...
It was huge.
Yeah, and we talk back to that Morbius episode. I mean, the ripples of everyone wanting to do copycats of his movies were huge. I took a stab at this one because it was right after Spider-Man 3 wrapped, so it was kind of a return to horror for him. And I didn't. The only other movie between this and Doctor Strange is Oz the Great with James Franco.
We don't really know.
Yeah. Which is not a good movie.
I don't think producers are all. Yeah, they don't need it.
Yeah, yeah, you know. But since the goofiness of Evil Dead was just not really my bag, not necessarily bad, but just not my cup of tea, I was interested in him taking on straight horror. Even. This is not your style of, you know, this run-of-the-mill horror as it sounds like. Drag Me to Hell sounds like a pretty generic horror movie. I gotta say, this really has his mark as a director.
Really?
Yeah, this was a very good movie.
Really?
I was surprised. I mean, again, it sounds just as about as generic and bland of a horror movie.
And like I said, I haven't even, like, heard of it.
But it is.
Justin Long, who's usually comedic.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Is in it? I mean...
yeah. And not like a good cast per se, but wow. I'm telling you, this was an above average watch. The story follows Christine Brown, a very simple girl who lives a simple life. when her day job has her crossing paths with an old mystic kind of gypsy woman. A curse has been placed on her that basically invites a demon to drag her to internal damnation, to drag her to hell.
Okay.
It's not really too, you know, too complex. It definitely could sound very generic for folks at home, but in that ways, it's kind of intentional. It's definitely trying to have the same campiness, definitely has the same type of simple setup to invite a lot of craziness in that we saw in the Evil Dead trilogy.
Okay. People can go back and listen to it. We hit Sam Raimi stuff. And that comes up really, absolutely, really hard in some of our earlier episodes, for sure.
Absolutely. But this movie has just so much originality to it. It is a seriously good watch. It is a solid horror movie, which I just, again, I was not expecting whatsoever.
Yeah, it's,
you know?
it's PG-13.
Yeah.
You know?
So
it's snappy 139, though, which I like.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, it was very snappy. I think that's a great point.
Yeah.
It was not
messing around.
Have fat to it, which was definitely part of my enjoyment. So while there is little comedy in this, there's definitely still campy aspects. Raimi is writing here as well. Mm-hmm. So he is not afraid to make the setup intentionally cliche, intentionally goofy in his own way. Our character, Christine Brown, just all she wants is an assistant manager job at the bank. You know, that's really the goals of her character, but she's getting dragged to hell. So, you know what I mean? There's that clicheness, that campiness is intentional to just... let's get the audience up to speed and let's do what the movie's actually about.
That's cool. And it's got a little bit of Sam Raimi's history with some horror stuff.
Sure.
The funny and lighthearted.
Absolutely. We see that a lot in goofy scares. I think if there's going to be a cornerstone, it's goofy scares. This film is not afraid to get some gross out humor, some gross out horror to this.
Okay.
I don't want to spoil it because, I mean, you know, the shocks are part of obviously the horror and the enjoyment of it. But the point I'm trying to get across is it breaks
the mold.
It may look like Lost in the Shuffle horror film. Why would you ever waste your time watching that? The execution couldn't be further from the truth.
How refreshing, honestly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, very absolutely. Cool.
I was not expecting it.
Good for Sam Raimi for keeping his, you know, there's elements of him in this through and through, but it really sounds like he just like went at it.
Yeah.
And good for him.
And it's cool because this is right after he wraps Spider-Man. He clearly, his roots are horror. He's writing here as well. This had to be like a really fun movie for him.
I think he wrote it with his brother too.
Oh yeah?
Because it's Sam Raimi and Ivan Raimi.
Oh, there you go. There you go.
Yeah.
I think that's just so cool that he has basically kind of FU money coming off of, you know, probably one of the most successful, you know, superhero trilogies of all time.
Right.
I mean, granted, 3 is a dumpster fire, but...
It's
done.
In the wake of that movie.
Absolutely. Yeah. He sees all the copycats being made after him, you know what I mean? So it's cool that he can return to his horror roots. The scares and the horrors, though, are a huge highlight. Raimi's camera work zooms and zips and snaps around. It's just very iconic for how he portrays it. And I can't stress how much that makes a different type of scare here. You know, this movie still has jump scares, but it in the execution and in the characterization that Raimi puts into his camera work and his scenes, the end result couldn't be farther from your average 2010s horror movie, you know, twice a year kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting. Jump scares are just, it is the gimmick of all gimmicks.
Oh, yeah.
And something that we've covered on horror movies where it's just like, you know, a lot of jump scares, this, that, and everything. Mm-hmm. But if he's doing jump scares, and yet he's making it good, I think kudos to him.
It's how the jump scares are shot. Sometimes the jump scares aren't scares. Sometimes they're jump gross outs.
Okay, all right.
You know what I mean? Which is, you know, it's not a dinner watch.
Right.
You know, don't watch this movie while you're eating per se. But again, it was refreshing and has such a unique originality to it. Really, really good. I gotta give props to this movie around these scares of just shocking me multiple times. I like jaw dropping.
Really?
Shocking.
You've seen a lot of horrors.
Absolutely. And it wasn't that it was like, oh, I'm scared to death of this.
Right.
If anything, you know, it had some goofiness to it, but Really, yeah, there's just some setups that's just like, wow, I mean, you just never would see that in a movie today, and especially like a, you know, a corporate, you know, Hollywood horror
sure.
movie.
Cool.
So I would say the scares, really, once we get past some of this cliche aspect or this cliche setup of Christine Brown, the scares are a mile a minute. When we get this demonic force introduced, it is no holds bar. And that was refreshing as well, because so much is padding, you know, in these horror movies. We have to pad it out, so there's like, oh, there's a, you know, a little bit of a slow burn, slow build up until,
yeah, and fluff, you know, really, in yeah, a way. Sure.
Until we have to actually confront this. But Christine is throwing everything she can at trying to get this curse off, and the demon is throwing everything again at pulling her to hell. I mean, it is straight up like shoving her in parts. she has near constant hallucinations. Like, it is nonstop hallucinations.
Wow, okay.
I mean, man, the list goes on with it, and it was just, again, refreshing is the word here. I would say a big downside for me is that for what was such a highlight to the early Raimi films was practical effects work, mm-hmm. and practical effects to the gore and whatnot. This movie is unfortunately a little bit chock full of 2009 CGI.
Yeah.
And 2009 CGI ain't good.
No. Yeah. Coming off the Spider-Mans, maybe.
Yeah.
He's in Hollywood now, big time.
It's true.
He's a player at this moment.
Oh, absolutely. And yeah. A big return with Doctor Strange.
That's a shame. So. That's a shame.
Yeah. It's just...
How much CGI was there? Or was that like...
Unfortunately, it's tied to a lot of the... Not the gross-out effects, the mm-hmm. scares, the blood. And granted, a lot of it is tied to our character's hallucinations, so it doesn't necessarily need to be... She doesn't need to be, like, drenched with something.
Right, right.
Because it's ultimately not real, but it just doesn't look good, unfortunately.
Okay,
it is a very...
It took from it a bit.
...unfortunate blemish on an otherwise very surprisingly good movie.
Okay.
So, and I would say I have to make such a big point out of it is because, again, chock full is really how...
You can't get away from it.
Exactly.
It's taking you out a little bit.
Yeah.
That's shame.
So, it really is a shame. Other than that, though, like I said, this is a solid recommendation from me. If you are a horror fan that is tired of formulaic scares mm-hmm. and the modern horror landscape, give this a watch. Moreover, if you are a fan of Raimi and his roots in Evil Dead, this is a love letter practically to that type of genre, mm-hmm. and this should be a priority watch for you. We're going to go ahead and give Drag Me to Hell a 73.
73 is a great score.
Yeah. And honestly,
that's,
I mean,
awesome.
I had a ball with this movie. It was a
lot
of fun.
Anyone into horror, because like you said, the formulaicness of it and how much shit you have out there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is kind of a breath of fresh air, big
Absolutely.
Time.
Absolutely.
That's awesome. That's actually really great. Okay, so 73 for Drag Me to Hell. That's 2009. We're now jumping 10 years in advance. We're in 2019. This film is Waiting for the Barbarians. Vin, a movie not really on my radar all that much.
Yeah, this one landed on my radar because it looked kind of just cool.
Okay,
in 2019, you know, it's just something that I wrote on a list.
The actors are good, too. Mark Rylance is great. Johnny mm-hmm. Depp, of course, can be great or bad, but mm-hmm. he's Johnny Depp.
And he is good in
like
this,
him. Yeah.
Luckily.
And Robert Pattinson, who is really proving himself mm-hmm. as quite a good young mm-hmm. actor.
Absolutely.
So what do we have with Waiting for the Barbarians?
So no experience with this director, Ciro Guerrera. Mm-hmm. From what I can tell, the genre of his movies are very diverse, though, so might be a worth dive into. He has a lot of international films, but he's all over the map in terms of genres, so definitely has some creative vision behind this. This movie, from what I can tell, is a fully fictional story around a central Asian colony owned by the British or kind of some fictional imperialist empire. The tone of this film is colonialism, imperialism, suppression.
Definitely,
or something like that. The barbarians here refer to the nomadic tribes that come in and out of the land, but equally, the barbaric nature of the colonizing empire is really what the knives are out in this script for, and the point that it's trying to make. This colony is overseen by Mark Rylance, who plays a calm, peaceful outpost leader, clearly someone that is not going to be supported by the British Empire or this fictional empire.
Uh-huh.
really, he's more interested in anthropology than even ruling, you know? I mean, he's trying to just kind of understand the land and the people and whatnot, and of course, that is in direct conflict with the aggressors of his other leadership within the military. That is in conflict with two standouts here. Unfortunately, they don't get a huge amount of screen time, but Johnny Depp and Robert Pattinson, who play more button-up, straight-laced, you know, posh.
Johnny Depp looks funny in the movie.
Oh, like funny, like haha, or like
kind of.
No,
he's good.
Yeah, he's cool. He's very cool.
Oh, okay, that's good.
Yeah, I mean
the glasses they gave him. I'm now remembering this, seeing even the trailers for this. Yeah. And it's like, what are they trying to make him almost like an Asian general type guy? Seriously.
Yeah, yeah. It's true. And it is kind of in like a little bit, but it's supposed to be like in the Himalayas or kind of some sort of, you know.
That's, yes. You know, yeah. But it's good. But no, he sells it.
Yeah, no, he does. He does. He's he's very posh. He's the reason why he wears the sunglasses is because like they just got introduced in like the main cities and whatnot. Of again, it's all fictional. They don't even reference a single thing. So
okay, which is kind of cool in its own way.
Yeah, it is. It was a little bit mind wracking for me as a reviewer though, because then I was like, is this fucking real? Or like, you know, like I was trying to researching the sepoy rebellions, right? And you know, and British colonialism.
That's
I was like,
funny.
This is nowhere. This is all useless.
and also Robert Pattinson, you said, was also good.
Yeah, in the same type of, obviously the villain, obviously a little cartoonish, but a cool depiction. And basically these characters are supposed to represent a kind of clash in ruling philosophy of these of this colonial area. I would say both Johnny Depp and Robert Pattinson are, you know, being among these ranks. And as far as villains go, we see them to be very brutal here. Because the subject matter of torture and conquest, I wouldn't say these characters are likable villains, but both bring a lot to this role to create an intrigue into their character. Like I said already, Depp is very posh. He's very uptight, but you can tell there's a, you know, again, a barbaric nature beneath him. And Pattinson is just straight up a beast in some aspects, you know, so much so that he doesn't speak in like full sentences and whatnot. Could be a little bit cartoonish. I think it was necessary, though, to kind of create the conflict in.
Does he play kind of like a crazy person?
A little bit, kind of like a
little manic, or?
Almost like a feverish military. You know, you know, he doesn't see the atrocities.
Is he playing like the young gun coming up and trying to make his mark?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, all right.
Absolutely, and someone willing to get their hands dirty as well. And that's where it's kind of, you know. He's almost a little primal, if you will, in this. So, enjoyable. The real shame is that combined, Depp and Patterson probably only get 30 minutes of screen time on this.
Oh, it's Mark. Yeah. That's how heavy it is on Mark Rylance.
Yeah, yeah. It's so much that it was like, why put him in top billing at all?
Okay. You know? that's a shame.
Yeah, yeah. Because, I mean, this really landed on, I was watching it for Depp. You know, I like Mark.
Well, he's got that new courtroom drama, right? That we'll get.
You know, it's top of mind.
It's topical.
It's top of mind.
Topical joke. Yeah, topical joke.
You know, yeah.
But no, because so now you're taking two of those guys away. So it's what, about a 2-hour movie, and they're in it for a small amount of time with Mark Rylance. Is it a boring movie now?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And then this is, yeah, you hit it on the head. And I like boring movies. You know, don't get me wrong.
And I like Mark Rylance.
Yeah. The movie is focused on kind of chapters broken into seasons and showing that. Before Depp's involvement, the outpost flourishing and then slowly degrading more and more with the meddling of the empire into what clearly, you know, more of a hands-off ruling philosophy to this, more of a kind of a merchant king. Yeah, it's, you know, I mean, it's kind of cool. There's a lot done into the set, but also because we're so focused on the outpost, we're like just stuck in the outpost. So even the visuals get boring after a while.
You're basically just looking at sand dunes, right?
Yeah. Exactly. So, you know, perhaps this, you know, calling this a very slow film slow burn doesn't even do it justice. It's like that. Slow smolder.
It's that bad.
Yeah, it's real
that slow. Wow.
Yeah, and again, don't get me wrong. I mean, one of our listeners, Craig Novak, he said to me, when you call something slow burn, you really just mean boring. Let me just say straight up, this is boring.
Some slow burns are good.
Yeah, but I mean, perhaps this could have been better. This is a novel.
Yeah, it is.
So
yeah.
Perhaps this could have given some more love to the adapting of a screenplay.
Yeah.
Quite literally like the opposite of Moby Dick.
Yeah. Yeah. Seriously.
And believe me, I don't think there is bad here to, you know, what message they're trying to show. Maybe it really just does need to be a slow type of story to show the gradual decline of what empires meddling in things that they shouldn't, you know. That really is the message and the critique of colonialism and
yeah, and I wonder if I
the
mean,
execution.
If
yeah.
Well, it's tough because if it's slowly, if you're watching it, if the book is a slow decline,
yeah,
and that could be powerful and everything in its own right. But man, like you said, when you're adapting it to a screenplay,
mm-hmm.
you have to give it to the audience mm-hmm. and have them enjoy it throughout.
Absolutely.
And so at the same point, it's like, okay, we could shorten it up a little bit, mm-hmm. but then does it really come across that it's a slow decline or this or that? But you got to do something.
Absolutely.
Maybe keep your interesting characters on longer.
Sure. I was going to say maybe there's just some stories that shouldn't be adapted for the screen. Absolutely. You know?
Right. But to your point, Moby Dick, which is a boring book,
mm-hmm.
They did
a good job. They did a wonderful job.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I would say more than anything, it is something to note. Like I've actually been loving making these kind of side notes to create some perspective beyond even just my own opinions of the film. If you know, folks at home, you don't like boring movies, this is a hard pass. So yeah, very, very okay. Cut and dry. Don't get me wrong. This film has plenty of critique about colonialism and the heavy hand of empires, but its pacing lessens the punch. It lessens the critique, if you will. It dulls the sword of what the movie and the script has to say. And even though, you know, there are very harsh visuals and the message it has to tell is intense around torture and the persecution of native peoples, I can't tell you enough. You are going to be bored to tears that by the time those intense scenes come along, it's not really going to make too much of an impact. We're going to go ahead and give Waiting for Barbarians a 52.
Ooh, 52. Okay. So mm-hmm. just over the cusp.
Yeah.
I don't really know what this movie, who this would be for, unless maybe huge fans of the novel itself.
Yeah, if anything, I think the movie kind of shoots itself in the foot not having some historical ties, because this could be a very history buff fan, yeah, you know, type
of movie. And the one thing
movie.
Is, when it comes to cinema, especially in like Hollywood cinema, mm-hmm. we don't get a lot of this era and like Northern Africa dunes or
sure.
where we're at here, mm-hmm. you know, between Tibet and China, those kind yep. of things are Mongolian type mm-hmm. type plains or
absolutely.
Or deserts.
Yeah, this is supposed, I think it's supposed
we don't
to
have
be.
Much of that or like World War I in that era.
Yeah, absolutely.
Especially like I said, Northern Africa, just that sand dune aspect,
mm-hmm.
it's just lacking. So it's kind of exciting when something pops up, but here it is kind of failing a little bit, which
yeah.
is upsetting.
Yeah, exactly. Exciting, too, for the time of military as well. It's very
yes.
it's very posh military. You know, they're very well-dressed and whatnot. So, I mean, there could be some window dressing here for some people that if they like that time period, maybe this is a little bit more of a positive recommend.
Right. So. But overall, for most audiences, it's eh.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's okay if it's on in the background.
Certainly not a bad movie, but nothing really redeeming in it as well.
And I think a 52 says just that.
Mm-hmm.
All right, very good, Vince. So that was our four previously released films, everybody. So we're going to go ahead and do our last film in theaters now. We do want to just take a moment here. And remember, this is when we would be doing the producer segment. There's no producers for this episode, but that's okay. We're new and everything, getting the ball going. Vin and I host the show. What we like to do is have the value for value model. So if anybody out there is getting value from the podcast, when you're going on the website, is it you finding that valuable? Then could you put a dollar sign amount? What is the value that you're getting from us? You can go to thedailyratings.com, you go to the donations tab, and then you can give us a donation. And what happens that is you are now an official, actual credited producer of the show. And we think of you as producers, not really listeners. Along with your donation, you can send it a note, which we'll read on air. And if you want to be anonymous, just click the anonymous box, and Vin and I will know who you are, but mm-hmm. we won't say your name to everybody else. And the note could be funny, it could be critiquing, it could be just random questions for Vin and I, whatever. You're taking the time to produce and donate money our way. And as a producer, a little perk to that. It's just like, hey, you know, you get some airtime and, yeah. and
last week, I think it checked all the boxes too. You know, yes, it was praise, it was critique, it was recommendations, you know, which was great.
So that's what this is. Again, it's a value for value model. We're not the first to do it. We're just going this way because we think it's the best. We think it's the best way to have the best product for you, a great through line to you. We know exactly what you like and don't like. It's creating dialogue and it's much more closer to everyone who does listen to this and to you producers. And so we're going to try this out, see how it goes. Now, also because we do this, you don't have to listen to ads. You don't have to deal with ads on the website as well. We're having a good time doing it. It's very, very time consuming. It does take a little bit of money. So anything that you all could kind of send our way, we greatly, greatly appreciate it. And hey, if you just don't have that much extra money to send or anything like that, a huge thing is, hey, give us a good rating on iTunes. Mm. Tell a friend, tell a family member about
it. Absolutely.
Again, we're just starting this out. So as we grow and grow, every little bit helps. Every person that you can put a little bug in their ear about is just so great to us. So we're trying to do things a little bit differently. We hope you're all enjoying it. We've been hearing good things from people, which we so much appreciate.
Yeah, absolutely.
But again, this is dailyratings.com and you go to the top right. This is the donations tab. And we thank you all for those who produce the podcast and the website. All right, Vin. So with that said, we're going to go into our 2022, our newly released, now in theaters film. Here we go. Big Marvel movie. This is Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness. And we were not fans. You and I were both not fans of Doctor Strange, his role in the new Spider-Man, Spider-Man movie.
Yep, yep.
What did we get with his own film here with the second? This is Doctor Strange movie film two,
yes,
correct?
Film two, okay. Yeah. He had his original, which kind of boiled down to mystical Iron Man in format of the script. Right. Luckily, though, this movie is pretty damn unique. Sam Raimi is returning to the MCU after really starting the whole thing with Spider-Man. Like I said already in the Drag Me to Hell review, as far as his mark, it cannot be understated how much of a tone that Raimi created with the modern superhero movie, with the origin story and what he did with Toby with Spider-Man.
Yeah, yeah.
It's really big. So I'm happy to say that Raimi might be the only director to make a modern MCU movie that actually feels like his own. There is definitely a little bit here that puts a crowbar in a movie and then kind of opens it up to fit in more Marvel lore and whatnot and plugs to future properties, you know.
Okay.
Unfortunately, we can't escape that too much. But when it comes to the feel of this pressure of Disney, the Disney overlords over these films,
I mean...
really, every one of these movies, it does not feel like the director has their mark on this. And this, surprisingly, really does feel like a Sam Raimi movie as much as Drag Me to Hell, as much as Evil Dead, even, you know, which was awesome.
It's freaking awesome to hear. Yeah.
And good for him.
It's a good note that you said when you're, if you are a director and you're making a Marvel movie, you really aren't the top guy because Marvel is just so involved with it, which I think is part of the problem of formulaic.
Absolutely.
And that's why every Marvel movie is pretty much the same.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But very good to hear that Sam Raimi, of all movies of Doctor Strange, second Doctor Strange movie.
I know, yeah.
But what are the differences? What can we expect kind of the tone and everything?
I would say it's an above average Marvel movie and definitely pleasantly surprising in a lot of aspects. I would say as far as for my hardcore Marvel fans at home, folks at home, this is very much in the vein of like a Thor Ragnarok in its comic book deep cuts. It has a lot of fun, how much fun it's having with the premise.
Okay.
But not in a bad way.
It makes me nervous hearing
fun
that.
Fun is not like, I mean fun in the way that it is. Just there's no real tracks to where it's going.
Okay.
It's going in a lot of directions.
Okay. Oh, gotcha.
You know,
okay.
It's not hitting the usual checkpoints of what, for instance, original Doctor Strange was. It was just Iron Man. You know, as far as the format.
Right.
You know, what
right,
I mean, he's a cocky bastard, and then he loses some sort of powers, or he has a kind of a come around moment, and then he goes to his superpower dumb. So, I would say as well. I mean, you're not too big of a fan, but I think it has a little bit of elements of what is right in Iron Man 3. In that
you weren't that big a fan either.
I know. I I was a turncoat on Iron Man 3. But it successfully peels back layers to our characters to give us what we really want in the end result, mm-hmm. you know? So I would say very, very interesting. This is definitely above average Marvel, just kind of going in, and especially for folks at home, if you're not looking for any spoilers whatsoever, I mean, not that, you know, my summary is going to be spoilery, that I would say is above average watch is where we're focused on.
Okay.
Story-wise, we're involved with three main characters among, you know, probably countless secondary sub-characters.
Okay.
We have the introduction of American Chavez, who is the center focus here, a fairly new comic book character. I believe she just got introduced in 2011 in the comic books. She has the power to punch holes in the multiverse, and that entangles both Doctor Strange and Wanda, the Scarlet Witch, from the very popular WandaVision on Disney Plus, into kind of a dimension-hopping chase. Doctor Strange's story is, of course, trying to keep things normal, but oddly takes a back seat a little bit in his own movie. He has cool action sequences, but as far as character development, this was giving me my same feeling that I had with Black Widow, that it was like, why are the character-defining moments, the actual emotional beats, not delegated to our main character, you know, that the movie is entitled?
No, of course. So were they handed off to Elizabeth Olsen or Benedict Wan or...
Yes, Scarlet Witch or Wanda, she is definitely the recipient of that. And in a very good way, though, she is the best part about this film, by far.
Okay, that's good.
So it is not, it's a critique for me because let's say Doctor Strange was my favorite comic book character.
Sure.
And Doctor Strange was my favorite MCU movie. Couldn't be farther from the truth, but okay. But hypotheticals. You know, I think that is kind of a knock to a movie that our main characters takes a back seat. Strange has a lot of cool moments in this, but if we think about what his actual story is in this from start to finish, what, you know, specifically the end note kind of lands
on. Right.
It's nothing. It's like barely anything, you know.
I don't know. I think that is upsetting. I mean, that's good that she was great.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, I mean, I think we know what Marvel is trying to do, which is definitely get more female roles
Like
building up roles. But it's like you said, it's a Doctor Strange movie.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's just weird. It's very weird.
It's odd, yeah. A lot of development is put to our new character, America Chavez, but also a huge focus is put on the character development of Wanda, piggying off the back of a very successful Disney Plus show. I think probably the most successful Disney Plus show of these secondary Marvels. It was also the first, too, so I think it kind of captured some you know, lightning in a bottle for the first time.
Yeah, for sure,
you
for
know?
Sure.
And I never watched WandaVision. I have to keep up enough with the with the MCU homework that is needed. But I would say, yeah, it's kind of 50-50 because I really don't like these shows having to be added to the required reading, and more we're going to be seeing that coming into play here.
Do you think required? I mean, we know her from the Avengers movies, no?
Yes.
Like her
character development, and specifically where we pick up with her, is right at the end of the show, you know?
Oh, really?
Yeah, and if anything, with the changes in development in her character after the show.
Okay,
so.
All right. Oh, okay.
It could be also a good point that Raimi, he's not writing this here. Someone else is writing this, but overall,
Michael Waldron.
There we go. Michael Waldron. He's probably more excited to use Wanda as a creative palette for emotional beats in this film,
mm-hmm.
because guess what? He had a whole TV show to piggyback off of. You know what I mean? And I'm not saying that in a negative way. That's using good momentum in the fan base in storytelling.
For sure.
You know?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
It just seems like one big juggling act. To be honest with you.
Yeah, there's a lot of things going on. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's multiverse, there's a lot of things to tackling. But I can't stress enough, some of my meh-ness to it, Wanda is definitely the best part about this film, and that's huge. And she's awesome in this.
Wow.
Like, it's really cool. In addition to the focus feeling out of place, you can feel the looming presence of Disney Plus subscriptions on your wallet. and since these shows are becoming more prevalent, excellent. I would say, again, if you're a hardcore Marvel fan, you might have watched WandaVision already, just because I think, again, it really held the crown and probably still holds the crown of those spinoffs. Mm-hmm. But I just got to say, I am not excited for more of that to come into play. So just still sticking on Elizabeth Olsen as Scarlet Witch here, it is a bit 50-50. She is absolutely 100% the best thing here. But, I mean, the good that she has is actually really in line with Raimi's horror roots. There are some very cool...
Really?
Oh, yeah. This is a very cool movie for what Raimi is able to do in a MCU movie. And no less, what, PG-13?
Oh, absolutely. PG? Oh, for sure. No, PG-13 all
G?
The way.
You know? Just to sell it to every kid possible? Yeah. We'll give you the tickets.
It's really making me want to... This reminds me of... Because Sam Raimi did all three Spider-Mans, correct?
Yeah.
With Toby?
Yep.
And wasn't there some great kind of darker elements or darker horror stuff with like the character of Venom in that third movie?
Venom, certainly Doc Ock in the second one as well, has a almost like an Evil Dead sequence when he's getting his powers.
Okay, okay.
You know?
So there's definitely like his finger. That's nice to see that his fingerprints aren't here.
Oh,
and it's
yeah.
just being like washed with this like mm-hmm. MCU genericness of Disney.
Yeah, I would say this is probably 1/5 MCU genericness, 4/5 all Sam
it's
Raimi.
The best news. Honestly, yeah. that's huge.
Yeah, this is absolutely a Sam Raimi film. And again, that's where I come into a fairly positive rating on this, you know. And not that I'm just bowing down to Sam Raimi either. The type of refreshing aspects to it are enjoyable, but they also are meaningful in a comic book setting.
Okay.
And where the MCU is at as well. So I would say also, Scarlet Witch, one last note with her is that for the hardcore fans out there, comic book fans that have been crying over a real or rather a comic book accurate depiction of Scarlet Witch as a immensely powerful character, we are finally getting to get into that a little bit in this movie, so fans can finally rejoice on that. I would say another aspect that breaks the mold here from a normal MCU movie is the creative action and mystic powers we see peppered throughout the movie. There's a lot of smaller beats to the plot that we get cool fight sequences or a creative trap here, and it goes a long way to keep the plot fresh. You know, these are not just your normal Marvel kung fu or fake kung fu back and forth.
Okay.
Strange has a very unique arsenal of magic fights, creatures as well. They're not just fighting people, they're fighting like monstrosities.
Fantastic Beasts almost.
More Fantastic Beasts than the last two movies of Fantastic Beasts combined.
But that's good, because the one thing about Doctor Strange is it's like the weirdness of it. I mean, you watch that first movie and it's got like, it's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
Because you have so much, like as you said, in the arsenal.
Yes.
To play with Benjamin and also Wong's character as well.
Yep. Just all the magic of the world.
Yeah, exactly. So that's good to see that it's not...
Yeah.
It's fun to watch, I guess.
Absolutely.
You know, it's weird to say it's generic, because the genericness of it is that it is crazy and you have so much to use.
Mm-hmm.
So it's good to see that at least it was enjoyable.
Yeah. And if I had to really take my knives out on that first one, it was crazy, but it was kind of just like a kaleidoscope CGI filter on the CG set that behind
them. Very true.
Where this, they're taking... Okay, Doctor Strange is a sorcerer. Let's face some weird, like almost Dungeons and Dragons monsters. Like there's fantasy
That's
monsters.
Cool.
There's
That's
fantasy
neat, yeah.
aspect to it. So I will say, I will admit, I was watching the clock a little bit on this one. I don't usually note it because I don't usually watch the clock, but I definitely was here.
It's like 2 hours and 6 minutes, too.
Yeah,
you know?
It's
not like 2.5 or anything.
I know. It was a little bit of the cat and mouse. I would say this plot could probably wrap a lot quicker if it wasn't for maybe a part in the second act that we have things pried open for more Marvel lore and plugs to other IPs and movies to come. I would say it's, you know, hey, it wasn't bad, but it was more panning, and I think this could have been the 1/5 of the Disney meddling in an otherwise very Sam Raimi product.
Absolutely.
So,
okay.
Quick note, soundtrack is, I don't know if I like it. But it's definitely interesting. Danny Elfman is on the soundtrack, and who has done everything from Weird Science to the band Oingo Boingo to, of course, being the voice of Jack Skellington in Nightmare Before Christmas. There's just weird electric guitar, and you don't hear electric guitar too often, and definitely not this much electric guitar in a score. Like, but, Strange will get off the ground, and it's like, like it's
really
it's kind of good. It's, I don't know, I'm really,
so it's not like 80s, like it's not 80s guitar.
No,
or is it a little 80s?
I don't know. I don't know what genre it is. It's like Doctor Strange with electric guitar is the genre. It's like mysticism, you know?
All right.
Maybe like a Steve Vai or something like that.
I'm interested in checking it out, honestly.
Yeah.
To see some of the Sam Raimi-ness in this music now.
Yeah. No, it definitely, and I think if that's the feel you're getting, Tom, then I think that's perfect for folks at home, too, because I think this was much more worth your time than a lot of Marvel schlock that comes out, you know? You know, I think it is absolutely an above average watch, definitely above average in the upper half of what Marvel can be, with a lot of points of originality. Also, you know, as much as I critique the Marvel homework that is needed with these films, this film is probably the most crucial film for required watching that we've gotten so far post Avengers Endgame.
Really?
Yeah, even more so than Spider-Man. There's a lot of ripple effect here. And I would say if, unfortunately, this movie is going to be kind of one of those that if you haven't watched it, you're probably going to have to do some homework in, before the next entry to catch up, you know?
So, sure, absolutely. Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think
we're in our next phase here. I mean, Iron Man's been played out, which we know. And so, you know, they're not stopping. We're going to have more Avengers and stuff coming out. So you think this is definitely one of the main post
bottleneck kind of, know, there's too many things referenced here that I think is for setup. And maybe that's a critique because it feels a little bit manipulative, but all these Marvel films feel that way, that they're always plugging the next entry.
Oh, you know what I mean? 100%.
And for folks at home, maybe you like that. You know what I mean? You like, you know, MCUs, I mean, it's, I would say we're done with the golden age of MCU, but they're still going to be making, you know, they're still making money. You're still,
there's a lot in the works still.
Yeah, this was definitely the most crowded theater experience I had in 2022 yet. So
okay, well, that makes sense, yeah.
Yeah, so I would say, though, for some, this movie could feel like a little bit of comic book whiplash with how much happens here. But I think the originality it sets up pushes it to be an above-average watch for both the MCU side and just a normal movie. And I would say this was by far one of the better MCU movies I've seen in this new phase post Avengers Endgame. We're going to go ahead and give Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness a 67.
Okay. 67. I was almost thinking 70s there.
Yeah.
But it's still a Marvel movie.
Yeah, and I don't want to get too much into it, but like I said, this movie is pried open to plug other Marvel stuff.
Yeah. Which is just like you said, you can't get away from it, really.
Exactly. And hey, it's their bag. They can do whatever they want with it.
Yeah.
You know,
a good distinction of saying, because it really is true. If we were looking at this in phases and we had phase one and two, phase two really does start after that, the Avengers Endgame.
Yes. Yes. Or, I mean, I think there's actually, Kevin Feige does have a phase labeling. I think we're
phase
four. So I don't know. Yeah, there regardless.
Are, yes. No, maybe they actually do look at it as phases because they announce, because we know what's coming on the next few years.
Exactly.
Like that. But as far as, I don't know, as a viewer, that's how I would
say. Yeah, I like that. I like
but
that
definitely
overall.
A step above Black Widow.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
A step above Black Widow.
Because that was the first big punch after, I would say, Avengers Endgame.
Yeah. We didn't review it for the podcast, mostly because I started it and stopped it two times, but Eternals, way above Eternals as well.
Does that count as the MCU?
Oh yeah, that's that's apparently MCU proper. So
and
I
Avengers
no
and everything. Oh,
yeah, I have no idea.
Woo. Okay. Yeah, that one's blew past.
Yeah.
By the way, I was looking at going to see theater. I think it was maybe last week.
Uh huh.
And sure enough, Spider-Man still was in a large theater.
Get out.
Like one showing.
It beat out. I think Batman dropped even
which is
more
just unreal.
That's wild.
And stupid.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay, getting off track.
Yeah.
So that was 67 for Doctor Strange, Finn. A really good week, kind of.
Yeah, no,
I like the array of
sports.
I like the array of movies. Absolutely. Like I said, I love exploring different decades.
Mm-hmm.
So looking at all these, is there anything else you'd like to add or roll credits here? What do you want?
No, I think that's good. We may not have the most exciting couple weeks as far as big releases, but I always open to recommendations. So folks at home, write in if you want me to give a shot to something. I can always use more ammo because five a week, I'm burning through my lists. The lists are going away. So.
And are they, just on a side note, are they finally coming out with the new Top Gun movie soon?
Oh, yeah. That'll be, I think, in June.
Oh, it's June release. Okay.
Yeah. And
I've that
got
pushed
seen...
back like 2 years, right?
Oh, really? I didn't know. I'm not a Top Gun fan.
No, of course. But it was just been in the news and Tom Cruise, all his own stunts, learn how to fly, this whole thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But, learning how to fly.
That was a huge COVID push, I think.
Yeah, for sure.
But okay, Vin. All right. Very good. So we thank you for stopping by here, Vin. And for folks at home, we're going to run through this one more time. We have Moby Dick with a huge 87%, Basic Instinct with a 68%, Drag Me to Hell with a 73%, Waiting for the Barbarians with a 52%, and Doctor Strange with a 67%. We thank you so much, folks, for listening, and we'll see you next week on the Daily Ratings Podcast. If you enjoyed the podcast, if you would, give us a good rating or tell a friend about us. If you're wondering if a film is worth a watch, or if you'd just like to see more movie ratings from Vince, be sure to stop by thedailyratings.com, where we have our ever-expanding catalog of films. Also, if you found value in the podcast or our site, become a producer and go to the Donations tab on thedailyratings.com. You can donate whatever amount of value you feel you receive from us. You'll get a producer mention on the next podcast episode, too. We're looking to build this into something large and great, but also be independent from those corporate sponsors. So we greatly appreciate any support from you all. So thanks so much, and we'll see you next time on the Daily Ratings Podcast.